You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the monthly podcast designed to support the online periodical www.electricsheepmagazine.com. As part of the service we supply for our readers and to help raise awareness of the magazine, Electric Sheep does monthly screenings at the Prince Charles Cinema near Leicester Square in London of various cult films, and each screening features a guest who introduces the film and or does a Q&A after the movie. In this podcast, you're going to hear a couple of Q&As recorded at Cowboy Films that we showed earlier in the year. Later in the podcast, there's a Q&A I hosted with Ian Rakoff, writer and raconteur who founded the Rakoff Collection at the Victoria and Albert Museum of some 26,000 comics from the last century. Ian also wrote the Western-themed episode of The Prisoner, Living in Harmony, and so in a talk recorded before a screening of the Sergio Leone movie For a Few Dollars More, we chatted about how Western-themed comic books were a big influence on his work, and whether there was a dialogue between Westerns on the page and the big screen. Before that, here's the introduction and Q&A to a screening of Midnight Cowboy by Emma Smart, who's a programmer at the British Film Institute's London Lesbian and Gay Film Festival.
Midnight Cowboy won the Best Academy Award, but it was actually the first X-rated film to win an Academy Award. It also won for Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay. But up until the point it was lauded by all the critics and awards were showered on it, The studio bosses were quaking in their overpriced boots for the fact that it depicted homosexuality in quite a overt way. Up until this point in the 60s, Hollywood had feared depicting homosexuality on screen. You might have heard of something called the Production Code, which was introduced in the 1930s, and it basically kind of like outlawed things being shown on screen, such as violence, bad language, sex before marriage and sex perversion, which is what they used to call being gay back in the day in Hollywood. But by the 1960s, the code had been pretty much cracked and sex perversion was the last thing to be broken. But Hollywood still liked its queers on screen to be, if not hidden, not really talked about. So when Schlesinger's film came along in 1969, centering on gay hustling on the streets of New York, he put the homosexual content front and centre, and the studio bosses tried to come up with all kinds of ways of kind of like tempering it down. One of their suggestions was it to be a musical vehicle for Elvis Presley. Why imagine that myself? But they did want Sammy Davis Jr. to be in the Razzo Rizzo role, so I don't know if you can imagine that when you're watching Dustin Hoffman. Thankfully, Schlesinger refused to kowtow to the studio bosses, and he got Dustin Hoffman fresh off The Graduate, and he got an unknown John Voight for something like $17,000, which, you know, that doesn't sound much now at all. And I think you'll probably agree with me that the casting really worked, and both of those actors did pick up nominations for Best Actor in this film, but it was the film itself that got all the awards, and I think that's probably down to the guy's name I can't pronounce. John, as I like to call him, honed his filmmaking skills at the BBC. He was first an actor, and then he was a documentary filmmaker, which I think is actually quite apparent in a lot of his narrative features, and in particular in Midnight Cowboy, where there's lots of street scenes, and it's kind of like, it's almost like he's got a hidden camera, and he's of Dustin and John on the streets, and they're doing their scene, but you get the impression that the people around them and the taxi drivers don't actually know that a film is being made. And just to kind of like finish with something who's far more intelligent than me, quoted from the Canadian film journal CineAction, they call this Midnight Cowboy John's masterpiece, a peerless piece of filmmaking that reveals an auteur at the peak of his powers. Perhaps, you know, take a look at the film, see if you agree, and then we can have a chat about it afterwards.
In advance of doing this Q&A, we discussed talking about gay cinema in the 60s, cowboy movies. But actually, one thing that struck me watching that film again, how it makes quite an interesting counterpoint to The Graduate, which was, of course, you know, the film that Dustin Hoffman was lauded for the year before. And there are loads of sort of similarities between the two films. The interest in male sexuality, the final scene in the movie with Dustin Hoffman departing on a bus. I mean, there's even a shot, although it's John Voight in this film, where he's framed underneath a woman's raised leg. I mean, have any of those things, you know, sort of gone through your mind on subsequent viewings?
Probably not so much. I mean, I suppose because I see Midnight Cowboy in a kind of like different part of cinema to something like The Graduate, which is so obviously heterosexual, and the Midnight Cowboy, which is so, I think, obviously not. And I don't know. I think it was a brave film for Dustin Hoffman to make straight after The Graduate. And actually, he has this funny story, and I don't know if it's true or not, because there's different kind of like these legends about lots of things in Midnight Cowboy, but apparently Dustin Hoffman asked one of the studio executives, because they didn't want to actually cast him in the role, because they thought, well, he's just too pretty. He's a very pretty, short man. And they thought, how is he going to ever play Ratso Rizzo? You know, maybe they thought Sammy Davis Jr. would be better, actually, because he's just too pretty. And he said, well, to the executive, come down and meet me on a corner of New York and, you know, 5th and 9 or something, and let's have a talk about it. We'll go for coffee and you'll see. And this executive was on the corner of this street in New York for about 10 minutes, and there was this beggar near him in a coat, all scruffy and everything, getting money off people in the street. And after 10 minutes, he came up to the executive and said, hi, it's Dustin, you know, can I have the job now? And that's how he got it, so...
Well, I mean, and that's the thing, he looks so young in The Graduate. I mean, he doesn't look, you know, 20 years old in this, but he certainly looks 10, 15 years and a lifetime of, you know, drugs and living on the street. It just, you know, shows what an amazing actor he is. Thinking then of the gay aspects of this movie, placing this at the end of the 1960s, it was still quite a controversial film to make, discussing male sexuality. I mean, it doesn't explicitly show any gay sex scenes, but the whole kind of leitmotif of the film, of the love that dare not speak its name, how did that go down at the time?
Well, I mean, it actually was quite successful. I mean, it got all the awards, it got 3 Oscars, it was an X-rated movie, and I think at this point, certainly in an American cinema, the studios controlled it a lot more than cinema over here, so we kind of like managed to come out with a film that explicitly talked about homosexuality about 10 years before America did in Britain. So, but something happened with Midnight Cowboy, and it was an X-rated movie, and people kind of like flocked to it because it was an X-rated movie, and they thought they were going to get, you know, something, I don't know, maybe something raunchier than they got. Or lots of people thought they were going to see a Western. That's, you know, that's also the thing. And it's hard to know. From the time, I think it was just a very good movie. And like I said, you know, it was finally, the studios had finally kind of like broken down and started making films that were more explicit about this type of sexuality. It was kind of like, you know, coming out of the Summer of Love, and there was just a lot more freedom in society anyway. And I think, you know, it's kind of sleazy, but it's an interesting film to place in the history of queer cinema, because at the one side it's really homophobic, but at the same time it's actually quite positive. And if you, I don't know, if you think, you know, my mate John, who made it, he actually came out much later in life. Like, he came out in the 1990s, but he did actually make all these films that have got amazing images, like eroticized images of men. If you've seen Far From the Madding Crowd with Terrence Stamp and the way he's shot, and you've seen his work, Sunday Bloody Sunday, which is set in the UK, and it's that's a story about kind of like a bisexual man in a love triangle. And then you've got Midnight Cowboy, which is like, is Rizzo and Joe, you know, are they a couple? Is it like father, son, and that role gets switched? He's clearly trying to say through his film something about his own, I don't know, making a comment about sexuality through his films that he wasn't quite able to kind of like come out and say in 1969.
Well, it's interesting because obviously the buddy movie has been a real staple of Hollywood over the last, you know, 30, 40 years. But increasingly it seems that there can't be any real affection shown between men on screen, and that actually seems becoming worse these days than it used to be. It used to be that the two male leads of any kind of action film or comedy were allowed to be more affectionate towards each other, even in just a playful way. But now it's almost verboten. You have to keep any kind of male friendship at arm's length. What do you think that is?
I know that of the Western, they've spoken about how it was actually kind of like legitimised male friendship, and it was actually the Western has traditionally filmed legitimate film to desire men, for men to desire men. We're going back to like the first Westerns in the 40s and stuff. So it's always had this kind of like, well, it doesn't matter what we think about like male friendship and everything in the real society, you know, if they're puffs or whatever, because actually if they're kind of like got a gun on their, you know, on their hip and they've got a cowboy hat, they're men and it's okay to hug men and it's okay to actually, you know, get on your horse and kind of like, you know, ride into battle. And I think there is something about masculinity today that is more fragile, and so they do feel more threatened by two men actually just having, you know, that kind of friendship that is completely platonic, although I don't think lots of Westerns that were made did have, I think, the subtext in them, and that, you know, it's not so platonic, but from the majority definitely are. And I do think today there is something lost between males on screen, is that the buddy movie now just doesn't seem to be what it was in the 60s. And there were lots of them in the 60s. I mean, if you think the biggest one was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And that is like held up by gay men all over the world, kind of like, oh my God, Paul Newman and Red, you know.
Yeah.
It's the pin-up, and especially the way that Paul Newman was just so gorgeous. And he... Even Joanne Woodward, his wife, said at the time of that movie, oh, they had great chemistry on screen. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, it's always hidden, so they just don't make those movies anymore the same, I guess.
By the end of the 60s, the cowboy movies seem to be dying out as a genre, with only Italy actually making any kind of serious cowboy films. And Ratso's kind of impression of John Voight in this movie as dressing like a cowboy, you know, it implies that there's something gay about his appearance right from the start. And so do you think that there was a queering of the cowboy image towards the end of the 60s anyway, before even this film started?
Oh, absolutely, definitely. I mean,
not shorthand, but certainly.
No,
you know.
Not shorthand. I mean, it started to be a motif of gay men to dress like cowboys around this time.
Right.
And you know, I don't know why that is, but I know that Richard Dyer has said something along the lines of it's the ultimate kind of... almost payback to heterosexuality that kind of like gay men are taking the ultimate in masculine kind of identity and dressing up and be, you know, kind of like using it for their own identity. So it's totally kind of like turning it on its head. And I think, yeah, by the end of the 60s, it's so prolific because obviously gay society is coming out from underground, it's coming out from the bars, it's coming out and being more visible. And this is one of the big identities that it had. So I think Midnight Cowboy comes along and absolutely captures that. And Ratso's right in saying that, you know, you look like a fag. No woman is ever going to want you. This is what the hustlers are doing. This is all for faggots. And he's so enraged that he's like, John Wayne, you know, John Wayne's like the ultimate kind of like male star of the Westerns and quite known... In real life, John Wayne, known for his bigoted views as well, I think it's quite a clever kind of to pick him out as being the ultimate cowboy because of the way that we know that he had quite bigoted views on homosexuality anyway, and kind of like even imply a little bit that he could be by saying, what, just because I'm dressed like that, he's a fag too. I think it's very clever, it's very subversive, which is why I don't always agree that this film is completely homophobic. I think it treads a very fine line. And incidentally, actually, the movie, the actor Oscar that beat the two guys in this was John Wayne for True Grit. And that's kind of like the Western.
Well, and I think it's interesting watching this film now after Brokeback Mountain came out a few years ago, because when's that set? Is that it's starts in the 60s, ends in the 80s.
It is, actually. Late,
so it's almost like a reevaluating of that time, of the way that they thought of cowboys now and the way that we think of cowboys now. That maybe there always was that subcurrent that was barely discussed at the time, except in films like that. And now when it comes to making films like Brokeback Mountain, they can look more honestly at the 60s and 70s and discuss what was going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. I think Brokeback Mountain takes the kind of like Western male friendship and sexuality to the degree that it can, because it was made in 2005 or when it was made. But I think that that kind of like tradition, if that could have been done back in the day when the westerns were being made in their heyday, I think it would have been. See, I think it would have been done if Hollywood or anyone could have depicted that kind of sexuality on screen. It would have been, because it was there anyway. Like, if you go back and look at those westerns, there is definite kind of like moments in the films where there's two men together and they're kind of like having a shoot off with their guns, and they're like saying, "Mine's bigger than yours, it's bigger than yours," and you're like, you know what that means.
Yeah.
And there's a film, The Outlaw, which is Howard Hughes' major kind of like western, is just so homoerotic. And I think probably Brokeback Mountain just kind of like looked back on that and thought, well, we can go that one step further and we can actually depict two men who meet in this kind of like desolate space and, you know, fall in love and then reflect it back at actually the society that they were in. Still didn't allow it, but they got away with it for so many years.
And it's interesting, in both cases, they both did so very well at the Oscars, so a real legitimising of the genre, you know.
There's always one. There's always a film that comes along in every generation. in every kind of like decade, I think there's one key gay film that comes along and kind of like comes along to get all the Oscars and stuff. And Midnight Cowboy did it, and then Boys Don't Cry did it, and Brokeback Mountain did it, and they kind of break through this kind of like shield, this glass ceiling that allows gaze to be on screen for the briefest moment of time, and we all think to ourselves, well, that's great, we've done it now, we've won an Oscar, we've won a, you know, we got the best actor or whatever, we're fine, we're going to have loads of cinema now that is going to reflect us and is going to kind of like put us back in history, and we're not going to need to kind of like find us in little bits and pieces all over, you know, we're not going to have to search anymore. And that's what, when was Brokeback Mountain? 5 years ago? Where's the next, you know, it's still not happened, it's still not brought it actually all the way out. So it does legitimise it to a point, but I'm still waiting for the next one. I'm still waiting for the female Brokeback Mountain, quite frankly. You know, we still have a glass ceiling to go through.
That wasn't even Cowgirls Get the Blues then?
Oh my God, no.
It's interesting as well that Boys Don't Cry is also kind of located, at least geographically, within the kind of the Western milieu. Right?
Well, I think that, it's...
Maybe because that is where American sexuality is kind of located geographically, in a sense. Kind of in the stereotypical Western.
Well, certainly Westerns were kind of like seen... They were supposed to be seen as America showing itself itself. And so they were allowed... Because they were kind of this fantastical, mythological space. No one really knew what it was to be in a Western, because by that time, the Western, you know, it was so long ago. So you could... It was almost like they were the first fantasy films, if you like. You could imagine what it was like to be in the desert, in the Alamo and all those places, and have that kind of space. So I suppose in terms of films now that are made that kind of like depict questionable or difficult sexuality, I suppose putting it into also those desolate places, I don't know, it adds some sort of
frisson.
Yeah, absolutely, some sort of gravitas to it, some sort of like, things aren't bad enough that I live in a crap town, I'm also gay.
Off the top of your head, do you know what they had to cut to make it an R-rated movie when it was originally rated X?
No, but I would imagine what they would have had to cut was a lot of... They are very blatant in saying faggot and gay a lot.
Right.
So I would imagine that had an impact. I should imagine kind of the drug scenes would have been a problem, I should think. When they made it R-rated, it would have lost a lot of what we have now from the film. Because if you take bits out of films, I always think it's a dodgy arena, kind of like, you know, just being selective, because it's a form of censorship, and I think, it's difficult to know and also wonder what John would have thought to his film being kind of almost like massacred to go to a mass audience.
Whether the message is more important.
Yeah, whether the message is actually more important to have it shown to few, or whether sod the message, we need to get bums on seats. But I think if that was the case in the first place, he would never have made such a film. It was a really brave film to make. I don't think that kind of like, I don't know if that gets across so much now with these kind of films, because everyone thinks, oh, well, Brokeback Mountain made loads of money, and that, you know, that kind of like had Jake Gyllenhaal in it and Heath Ledger, and they're gorgeous, and it's all fine. But actually, you know, these filmmakers really put their necks on the line, and certainly for John, he was fresh off making Far From the Madding Crowd, which is, was a massive box office failure.
Oh, really?
Oh, God, it flopped completely. Like, you look at it today and it's actually fantastic. And like I say, you know, Terrence Stamp is beautiful in it. And it's a really good film. But at the time, no one went to see it. So he's kind of like going up to the studios and rocking up saying, yeah, I've got this story about gay hustlers in New York. So I think he really did put his neck out for it.
And also, as a depiction of New York, it actually has similarities with Taxi Driver. It's kind of interested in the underbelly of New York. And the only real friendship in the film is between Joe and Ratso, and everyone else is just out for money. It, you know, it's just out to shaft you. By the late 60s, I wonder if people were becoming aware that the 60s themselves had been mythologized, because in that film, you have a kind of very realistic New York until they go to that party at the end. And it's almost like they've gone to a 1960s theme party. And so, if you know what I mean, do you think in 1968 they already were becoming aware that the 60s themselves were becoming appreciated?
Oh, God, absolutely. I think we always do, don't we, when we get to an end of a decade, we start like looking back and parodying it ourselves. And certainly by 1969 that would have been happening. It's also interesting, I think, with this film, it's definitely kind of like pegging New York for what New York had perhaps not been seen as yet, as this kind of like having this really dark underbelly of goings on and kind of like, and that's where, you know, there was a big underground film movement. I mean, if you're thinking of gay cinema in the 60s, there was still, if Hollywood tackled it at all, it was really negative, and everyone had to die in the end, and it was all horrific, and, you know, kind of like self-loathing, like the guy in the motel room who's like, I deserve this beating. But in terms of like proper, kind of like proper gay cinema, there was the underground gay cinema of the 60s was where you could actually kind of like see more positive portrayals of yourself, and that was happening kind of on the streets of New York and in the bars, and kind of like the whole Andy Warhol machine was beginning to kind of like really take hold. So I think John obviously knew about this and kind of like used that in his film, and that's what I think about that actually, which I think it's quite a jarring scene, the party scene, and I think it's probably, I don't know because I've not found this in my research, but it does seem like he's taking those underground films that were happening and the Warhol stuff, and he thought, oh, I like the way that that looks, and it actually is gonna be, you know, it does say something about the sexuality that is happening in New York, so I'm gonna put it in my movie. But isn't that the point of New York, that you're supposed to walk around and see kind of like, you know, film stars in every corner? If you kind of like are interested in this kind of cinema and seeing queer films in context from now or before, there is a strand that runs down at the BFI South Bank that I also program called Out of the Pictures. Every month they show something new, so come down there too.
Well, I think it's interesting watching a film like Midnight Cowboy just on its own, because it makes you want to watch other films that put into context. If you had more power than you currently do, maybe something that I would like to do, for example, if I had complete control over a cinema, would be to show something like Midnight Cowboy and then show all sorts of supporting material that kind of gives it some kind of meta surrounding, as it were.
Yes, that's what we can do with Out of the Pictures, because we can give it kind of like context, and certainly at the BFI we have the resources and knowledge to do that. But I suppose in a way also that's kind of like what we try and do at the festival. Each year we do try and do an archive strand of films that thematically kind of like link. We might have one central film and then do a meta season, a little season. I mean, this year we did we did Dorothy Arzner films, which aren't necessarily queer themselves, but she was a queer filmmaker in the 1930s and 40s in Hollywood, so it was interesting to look at her work to think, like, you know, how she managed to make the film she did. A few years ago we did queer noir. We looked at film noir, and you might not necessarily think that film noir on its own, if you just saw one film, like if you just saw Gilda, you might not think that's a queer film, but actually if you put it into context, Mm. And there was a cowboy season when Brokeback Mountain came out as well. So mm. yeah, it's a fun thing to do. If I owned the cinema completely, I don't think I would find enough queer films to show. Actually, I'm already struggling to program September. So if anyone's got any ideas, actually, let
me know. I'd like to thank Emma for coming and all of you for attending. Hope to see you again next month. Thank you.
The London Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, which is partially programmed by Emma Smart, is currently on tour around the UK, with screenings taking place in Edinburgh, Bristol, Leicester, Derby, Manchester, Nottingham, Sheffield, Dublin, Glasgow, Inverness, and Northampton. For more info, please go to www.llgff.org. Next, here's the Q&A I hosted before a screening of For a Few Dollars More at the Prince Charles Cinema in London with Ian Rakoff, and we're talking about the dialogue between Western-themed comics and the big and small screens, starting with his own work.
It was Gene Autry comics in particular that influenced Living in Harmony.
Ah, yes, actually. I stole the story for Living in Harmony, or filched, I suppose, if you want to be polite. But there's a Gene Autry in 1954, not by my favourite artist, but it's got the story of Living in Harmony there. Gene Autry arrives at this town, and the sheriff is operating a policy of no guns. So Gene Autry hands his guns in, and that's how the film starts, like that, Living in Harmony. And that's what took place, in the comic book. So there we go.
Did you find that Western comics in the 50s, for example, told a more interesting portrayal of the West than their cinematic equivalents?
Well, I don't know. I suppose the most authentic Western ever was probably Red Ryder, which is one of the few that was syndicated by Fred Harmon. And that, I think, started it in the 30s. I mean, a lot of these things up here are just my taste, as opposed to the essence of what the culture of the Western is about. But, I mean, Westerns are such a universal format for morality fable. And, of course, that's what appealed to me. And I'm thinking also, I'm busy flirting with doing a book on the stories that weren't in the Prisoner television series, and recreating, because I was going to do four more episodes, but then it went under. And what I would tackle would be the one element which I thought was absent in the series, which was the race issue.
Which you'd still tell as a Western morality.
Oh, yes, it's Western, yes, totally. Called The Galveston Giant and The Great White Hope. So any historians here about boxing might know what that means.
And thinking of ethnic minorities.
Ah, right, yes. I'm particularly interested in any of the authentic Indian comic books. Now this is probably, I'm going to jump onto this quickly. This is Everett Kinsler. And he's one of the most atmospheric artist writers in the comic book history of the early 50s. And everything is very melancholic and sad, and the storylines are superb and very distinctive.
Out of all the comics that you showed me, it seemed to be the one that had most like a Leone sensibility to it. There's the mention of Confederate gold, there's the ethnic minority who's set up as this great evil in the desert, in this case an Arab, which seems very atypical for a Western.
Well, yes. Also, what's interesting on that is that there's an Arab he's one of the villains, but he's a really good guy. And there's no hint of Islamophobia or anything that you would get today. And he's just part of one of the characters, except he happens to be obviously a lot brighter, more morally conscious, and an all-round better human being.
The kind of themes that Leone tackles in his films, in fact we've got the comic book sequel to The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, the idea of avarice in the Old West, the idea of tracking down the the results of massacres. That's obviously something that had become quite topical in the 1960s. I mean, it was by the end of the Dollars Trilogy, we're entering Vietnam and dissatisfaction with American foreign policy around the world. Do you see, you know, the Western law reflecting the events of the greater world?
Well, in a way, yes, because it was the 60s when I did Living in Harmony, and that was the one episode that was banned in France, and it was banned in America initially, because apparently, what I gathered was it was dangerously subversive. And, well, I don't know, I never know quite what that word means, but it's obviously what I have an inclination towards. So, you know, drugs, and also the idea of refusing to carry a gun. That didn't go down very well.
Well, I think it is interesting. One of the reasons I wanted you to come as a guest for this talk is the dialogue between comics and film that goes on. Obviously, Western comics rather than Western film influenced your episode of The Prisoner. And then when we get to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly comic, they've gone back to Leone's films in order to create new narratives, but are using the widescreen image as the basis of the panels. So I think, you know, there are two media, both film and comics, that can influence each other to, you know, very useful effect.
Yes, I don't know if there was much interplay between the two media, but I mean, I love the Anthony Mann, Bud Bettiger, the stuff from the 40s and the 50s. I mean, were wonderful westerns. And always there were these oddball things that tackled a morality. Well, look, Bad Day, Black Rock, for instance, where Spencer Tracy comes back to this small town and he finds out that this, I think it was a Chinese or Korean boy he'd come to look for, and he'd been murdered in the town. And he was there to give him an award. It was one of the great Spencer Tracy. He's a one-armed martial arts expert, isn't he, in that film?
And do you find these Italian westerns have any notably different morality to their American cousins? Because obviously they were creating a star out of Clint Eastwood, who had dabbled in the American western in Rawhide, but it was these Italian films that very much made him
smile. Well, yes, I mean, the focus was on Eastwood, and the orientation was definitely on the morality of it all. You know, there's all, and of course the authenticity was so good in those things. By authentic, I mean, it's of a piece and you really believe in that world, whatever that world was. So, well, thank you very much for coming and listening.
If you'd like to know more about Ian Rakoff's work, please visit our website, electricsheepmagazine.com/events, and click on the link for our December 2009 podcast, in which we're talking about his work in the British film industry on projects directed by Nicholas Roeg, Lindsay Anderson, and many more. If you'd like to hear Ian talk about comics in more depth, please come along to the Victoria and Albert Museum on July the 21st, where he's giving a talk called From Social Realism to Magic Realism, which is part of his ongoing series of talks, The Social History of Comics, and he'll be looking at such titles as Love and Rockets and Corto Maltese. And that's in the Sackler Centre at 1 p.m. More info at www.vam.ac.uk/activeevents, that's ACTIV_EVENTS. To find out more about Electric Sheep screenings, please go to electricsheepmagazine.com/events, where you'll find info about our monthly programme, which this summer includes screenings of Foxy Brown and Hero. Thanks for listening.